Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So did anybody get caught in that Biden snarl yesterday? The unexpected visit from Mr. 10%, the big guy, coming down from Wisconsin for a little funding confab in Chicago. And I guess I'm reading Lakeshore Drive was shut down and some people were, gridlocked, something akin to the great storm from a couple of years ago where people fled Lakeshore Drive and abandoned their cars.
Yeah, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Our referee for our game was really late. I mean, he's normally an hour early before the game starts. He came after the game started because you normally have two referees. But I'm just saying, and he said it was awful, and he's like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. Like, okay. He said nobody could move. That's all he said. But, yeah, it was so bad. All the news, local news is, all the local newscasts, you know, showed it. And then you had your Palestinian protesters, too, Dan, because they knew he was coming. So,
yeah, that's true, protesting outside of the fundraising event downtown. Well, as I tried to explain to people online, you have to give the president some latitude here. You know, I'm not one to give Biden a lot of leeway, but I'm not making excuses here, but again, some consideration for the President of the United States, because when you make surprise visits, like to visit the troops in a green zone in the Middle East, right. Just like Chicago, these hot zones that you fly into, if you're the President of the United States, you can't telegraph it because it's dangerous. So for national security reasons, you know, Baghdad, Kabul, Chicago. Oh. I mean, you can't offer advance notice that you're going to be in those areas. Because these are lawless areas with bands of warlords and they're beset by violence. And so, I mean, this is why you don't have heads of state visit these places very much, because of the concern over security. So I just, you know, wanted to offer a little consideration for the president to show how sort of even-handed I am.
Yeah. Did you see when he landed at O'Hare? It looked like Tony Preckwinkle made out with him. She was hugging him. It was so weird.
That's a good look.
Yeah, it was.
I'm not sure that
I think he was kind of surprised when she came running at him.
I'm not sure that she's his speed, or he's her speed, maybe.
I don't know, but
I don't know.
I think she smelled his hair, too. I mean, it was one of those weird hugs, Dan. I don't know how to describe it properly, but I should tweet it out.
Tony was married to that Zeus character.
Right, who had a family in Arizona.
Bared a striking resemblance to Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah, that's true.
That's more sort of her wheelhouse, if you will, when it comes to, I don't really want to talk that much more about Preckwinkle and men, but, you know, I'm just saying. It's interesting.
Girlfriend got had, you know, like a lot of women.
Well, speaking of the protesters that were outside of the Biden fundraising event, did you see that Chicago police are now, there's an internal investigation now into the police handling of pro-Islamist terrorists, these pit protesters at the Art Institute, that when they had to clear them off the Art Institute campus so that the diverse docents could continue their duties around that facility. there's, you know, somebody's feelings got hurt. And so now Chicago police again are being targeted and essentially demonized. Go clear the Art Institute. Oh, you did it wrong. And I'm not saying that you do the shoot to maim business here or you necessarily run roughshod over them, depending on how those people who are illegally occupying an area behave, obviously. But all of this business about being pushed out of an area you're occupying illegally, being arrested so that Kim Fox can then turn around and release you, maybe the Art Institute to pay for any, well, that's really not in Illinois. You don't have to worry about pretrial release in Illinois. You don't have to worry about bonding out, but other places you do. Anyway, just that whole deal with the policing issue, particularly when you see, as we've seen, that not only is Chicago a training center, not only Chicago is a training center for the agitators on campus and, you know, occupying other institutions for the same purpose, like the Art Institute. We saw that with the Teamsters, right? Here's what you should chant. Here's what it means. Here's how you chant it in Arabic. This is the Teamsters contributing with the use of one of their union halls for an organizing confab, a train the trainer event. Well, we see Emory University down in Atlanta there, and I'm sure this is happening elsewhere, which is particularly caught at Emory, showing where you have these agitators, these pro-Islamist terrorist protesters that are practicing the human chains and how to otherwise confront police if and when they do come to break up an encampment, an illegal encampment, for example. So now you're having the other side be financed and trained by professional revolutionaries, and the police, who are obviously trained, have to deal with that. So it's not just like herding cats. What they're doing is purposeful and intended to impede the police's ability to do their job. And the response from the city of Chicago is to investigate the police. And Brandon, John BLM Brandon, to issue statements like, I talked to the University of Chicago president and I told him, you know, we got to make sure we let these pro-Islamist terrorist protesters have their day and have their say and so forth.
And they're complaining, too, that, you know, on certain college campuses, they tied my hands too tight with the cuffs. And so sad, too bad. They gave you an ample warning, sometimes multiple warnings, to leave the area because you can't do that.
Yeah,
and it's the police's fault?
Well,
and I knew when I saw that on Saturday when they were clearing it, I'm like, oh, somebody's going to file a lawsuit.
I don't care about what these sniveling, bedwetting Ivy League students have to say, or Art Institute students for that matter. The institutional response is what we should be focused on. These one-off useful idiots, mainly on college campuses. I mean, they're for entertainment purposes only. What's not entertaining is the institutional response from colleges, from high schools in some cases, you know, school districts, and from city governments. Well, and federal governments for that matter. I mean, this stuff, like the stuff you care. I'll give you an example. I mean, I'm really enjoying the Princeton hunger strike, and I hope it doesn't stop. Not just because the median weight of the hunger strikers is about 260, but they're women. Just because they're keeping us updated on all that the university isn't doing for them while they're engaged in this performative hunger strike. So yesterday we brought you the open outcry from the encampment. Where are the doctors on site to check our vitals to make sure we're not wasting away and imperiling our health, even though we're doing this of our own volition? We got another update from Princeton, New Jersey.
Cold and hot at the same time.
Immunocompromised.
immunocompromised.
And based on the university's meeting yesterday with some of our bargaining team, they would love to continue physically weakening us because they can't stand to say no to unjust murder.
We are cold and we are hot.
At the
She's
same time.
She's wearing shorts. I mean,
cold and hot at the same time. You know, Congress, the hunger strike has an announcement. We are starving. If only there was something that somebody could do about that.
Oh,
you know, like walk 100 yards into the you know, whatever, the campus commissary and get something to eat. But no, but that's, you can't do that because, of course, Princeton is somehow a collaborator with a fictional genocide that isn't occurring. I mean, that Princeton, right? Again, this Princeton emphasis. So, I mean, you know.
Oh, keep it up. I want this thing to go on forever.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So that's for, I mean, what is there to say other than just to enjoy that? That's for enjoyment. That's entertainment.
Yeah, the comedy never ends. Okay.
But, you know, it is worth noting how radicalized these useful idiots are and intemperate. You know, I mean, all the other characteristics that go with being radicalized. So, for example, George Washington University, which has been a hotbed of this sort of nonsense, proximity to the Capitol probably has something to do with that. Although there have been counter-protesters there, too. There have been, basically a non-communist Satanists on campus promoting America and trying to shout down the vile things that these pro-Islamist terrorists have been saying. But this is real French Revolution stuff when you're having mock trials on the campus and sending people to the gallows.
The people find you
guilty!
Guilty! Guilty! Guilty! Guilty! Guilty! Guilty!
You know, maybe it's just me, but I find chanting guillotine an odd refrain for anti-war protesters. I don't know. As I said, mainly for entertainment purposes, except for the institutional responses, the responses where we expect leadership and a restatement of first principles of a free society. And of course, we're not getting that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So there is a new study out on the Pritzker Purge Law, the Orwellian entitled Safety Act.
Okay.
Loyola University researchers finding that, imagine this, that the new no cash bail system in Illinois is producing fair results.
Oh, come on.
And is making victims safer. That's what Reinhardt of Lake County said. Victims are safer because
right.
The release of, in many cases, people charged with and previously convicted of violent crimes. Interesting.
Well, that's a strange twist on that. Isn't Reinhart and Kim Fox are the only two state's attorneys that were for this act, right?
Two out of 102.
Yeah.
And they were for the original version.
Oh, that's right.
As was Jelly Belly, as was the entire General Assembly, until we made a big issue of it and brought it to the public's attention in the 2022 election year, thanks to the help of some state's attorneys like Jim Glasgow in particular, but others.
Yeah.
As well, who are willing to speak up on it. Sheriffs around Illinois as well. A study based on courtroom observations by Loyola University researcher. An observational study by Loyola. Found pretrial hearings before the reforms averaged 4 to 6 minutes in the four counties studied. After the reforms, most hearings increased by just a minute or so when a person's release was uncontested. Well, right. If both sides are not contesting the release of somebody, then there's not much to talk about. I mean, other than if the judge thinks both the prosecution and defense are upside down. I mean, okay. Detention, and by the way, this is not how you measure the justice system necessarily, but in terms of the idea of is this going to create a backload of cases and so forth. Detention hearings saw a significant jump with median lengths of 10 to 30 minutes, so say these observational researchers. But here's the upshot, right? What's the recidivism? Not even recidivism is that they have not been convicted of something, but the incidence of another crime allegedly being committed while they are waiting trial for a crime they allegedly committed.
Right.
People who are released have continued to show up for hearings. This reported to the Loyola researchers. This is memorialized in a NPR Times state-run media piece. People released have continued to show up for hearings with an arrest warrant being issued in only about 10% of the cases when someone fails to show up. 88% of people released have not been charged with a new crime. Of those who were, 4% picked up a case for a crime involving violence. Advocates of the reforms note that both of those things happen under the old money system as well. But this is supposed to be a reform. So if it's basically the same as the old money system, then why'd you get away with it? Why don't we look a little bit deeper at the old system and the judgment calls that people like judges and prosecutors are making when it comes to releasing people who go on to commit a violent crime? Isn't that the issue? Judges have granted detention petitions from prosecutors about 60% of the time. Again, this is observational. The Safety Act, the Pritzker-Purge Law, has only been in effect for about 6 months. And what this really is, in my estimation, I'm just even taking this as accepted. There's all sorts of problems with drawing sweeping conclusions from this. But even taking this as accepted, this is just propaganda. This is basically a statistical way to try to say crime's going down. The justice system is working better. Everything's fine.
Yeah. Vote for Biden because everything's fine.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I don't know how they can just make the blank statement of victims are safer. Fact-based evidence do they have on that? How are victims safer?
You're going to have to ask Reinhardt about that. I don't know. He just made that statement and... this is what they do. They make declarations. They don't really need to provide much evidence because, they're talking to the NPR Times. It's not like there's going to be pushback or a demand for supporting logic or information. No, of course not. But even if you take these data points at face value, 88% of people have not been charged with a new crime.
Well, we're supposed to celebrate that?
So 12% of those who are released are charged with another crime upon their release, pending the adjudication of the case for which they were released.
Well, those are preventable crimes. And if you ask any of those victims, who were victimized by those people, they would agree.
Well, that's it. It's the preventable crimes issue. 4% picked up a case for a crime involving violence. By the way, you know, when you're talking about numbers of people being arrested that are in the tens of thousands, you know, a small percentage of a big number can be a big problem. And Chicago has a big problem. I don't know if you've noticed. I know they're trying not to notice, but it doesn't change anything. So, for example, these stories, I know they're anecdotal, but they're also real. And it represents real victims and real perpetrators and real failures of the justice system. I mean, this, and they're daily, as most people know. Prosecutors say two men, including one on electronic monitoring for burglary and gun charges.
It's just an ornament on their ankles now, yes.
Committed a particularly violent armed home invasion and robbery last week. Oh, really? The guy on electric monitoring for burglary and gun charges, particularly violent armed home invasion and robbery. Mm-hmm. Officials say both men pointed guns at a man in the 2700 block of West 12th Place, taking his jewelry, keys, and shoes, then forced him to bring them into his nearby home, even though they knew young children were inside. One of the dudes pointed a gun at the man's head while the other dude held a gun to the victim's side as they threatened to kill him. At least one child saw the assault. One of the dudes had previously been placed on 24-hour curfew with electronic monitoring. That was just a couple months ago in March after prosecutors charged him with gun possession and trying to steal a car. His ankle monitor's GPS data indicated he was at the home invasion scene at the time of the crime because, of course, he's a master criminal, like most of them are. So those kind of stories. And, well, you know, this kind of story that is particularly gruesome, the guy who kidnapped a 15-year-old and sexually abused her for 5 months.
Oh, God.
So you saw this?
Where did this happen? I can't keep up.
he kidnapped a 15-year-old girl in December while she was walking to her home in Chicago. He kept asking if she wanted a ride until she relented, got in his car.
Oh, no.
She was pressed to drink alcohol, take drugs, and then was unconscious.
Yeah.
She awoke naked in the man's basement and was held against her weird for nearly 5 months while she was repeatedly sexually assaulted by this guy. He'd been arrested 52 times.
What?
So chant that. 52 arrests.
52.
52 arrests. 52. Right. And these stories are frequent. Do they represent a majority of the crimes committed in Chicago?
52.
No. But there's a small group of people who are representing a pretty significant plurality of crimes committed in Chicago. And it doesn't seem like, I don't know, after 52 arrests, I mean, I know everybody deserves a 53rd chance, but it doesn't seem like the observational researchers at Loyola have a response to that. So they bury it in data. It's only a small percentage. I know. I agree. It's a small percentage. Most people are law abiding. The problem is what the institutional response. Here we go again. What the institutional response is to that small group of people that are repeat violent offenders, that are predators. And when you have story after story of this, when you have series like CWB Chicago has done the last several years,
God bless
the number
them.
Of people being charged with a felony who've killed or attempted to kill somebody while out pending their felony trial. I mean, you know, the number over the last 3 years, numbers in the hundreds of crimes committed, and I'm sure north of 100 deaths when it comes to that universe of crime over the last 3 years. So, you know, probably three figures worth of deaths and mid three figures worth of violent crimes, killing or attempting to kill somebody, that could have been prevented if you restrained, or if you, I should say, detained most of these individuals who are repeat offenders for trial. And so that's a small percentage. 100 people in a city of 2.7 million and going down, 2.6 probably now, 2.4, I don't know. But That's a small number of people. Yeah, I know. And it's a small number of people who've been victimized, even if they haven't been murdered. Yeah, I know. But it's a big problem. And, you know, 100 deaths and many hundreds more whose death was attempted. I mean,
if it saves one life?
Well, their hypocrisy on that. Yeah. But I mean, you just can't like idly walk by that. It has impact beyond the person who is victimized for obvious reasons. But it also contributes to an overall culture or the disintegration of an overall culture of that would feature the rule of law, for example, or that would make the city attractive to locate to for a business or even a resident, for example. It's just a cheap way to walk past the failure of the political leadership in this state and the city, is what I'm saying. Frank and Tinley Park here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. Naperville's got a big crime wave, it seems, at Top Golf driving range.
Yep. Yeah.
Arrested 18 people.
Is it up to 18 now?
And then the owner was on interviewed with CBS News and said, well, just so you guys know, this is not taking place inside Top Golf. It's in the parking lot, weapons found in people's cars.
Right.
And they made their 18th arrest yesterday. I mean, they need to shut that thing down or something.
Well, thanks for the call, Frank. Well, I've seen some of the stories about that. It's not happening inside, it's in the parking lot.
Guy from Coal City drove all the way to Naperville. Whatever.
But it's happening in the parking lot, not inside. Are people parachuting in to Topgolf, or are they driving there?
Yeah, those people with the weapons in their car are using your facility, sir, and they're parking on the land that you own.
Well,
that's your responsibility.
By the way, everybody else who goes there and is not a criminal, is also using the parking lot.
Right.
And it's his responsibility to some extent. I mean, what do you want him to do? Put metal detectors out front of the parking lot and have people do sweeps?
Well, it's not only guns. There's a surge of drugs that are being confiscated and a number of stolen vehicles that are there as well.
It gets better. Why is that on the business owner?
If he's taking
reasonable precautions, it's not on the business owner. You sound like Lori Lightfoot. It's not on the business owner. It's emblematic of a culture of lawlessness. This is what I'm talking about, and it's good that Naperville police are being proactive. They know they've got a problem spot, and they're obviously heightening their presence if they're doing these checks, if they've made this many arrests for guns and drugs and so forth. But of course, it's happening in Naperville and elsewhere.
Naperville officers, the guns are in plain view, so they see them in the vehicle, and then...
Yeah, master criminals.
Yeah.
Marvin in Burlington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I just wonder, all these studies are the same kind of thing the Soviet Union used to do. They'd have these academics who were steeped in Marxism, make up studies, and use the twist numbers and to present a certain point of view, and tasks and prompt that would report it. I just wonder how long before society doesn't believe anything that the news media says. I mean, they did in the Soviet Union. They all knew that their news media was corrupted by the state, and they would listen to Radio Free Europe. And I just, how long before that happens in this country?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, thanks for the call, Marvin. It's happened in some quarters. There's a lot of people who say, like, you know, this reporting, like, oh, only 13% of Americans trust the media and stuff. Well, that's a bit misleading because they say they don't. You hear a lot of people say, I don't trust the Chicago Press Corps. And then there's some salacious story in the Chicago Press, and they're like, did you see that? I'm like, you're starting from the premise of trust or mistrust? If you're starting from the premise of mistrust, then you need to apply that uniformly, right? I know ultimately we have to believe in something. We have to believe some things are real. We have to find things that we can corroborate and understand to be the case. And we can do a lot of observational understanding of what reality is, just like those Loyola researchers did too. And people are definitely doing that. But I mean, I still think it's for all the stats about how the loss of credibility of the press corps, basically. It's the populace, particularly in urban centers, not nearly skeptical enough. Not nearly skeptical enough. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Bring it in, kiddies.
Now, this installment of Why Dan Proft is Single, it's because he wants to play a full round of golf. Let me explain.
Okay.
And by the way, this segues into the presidential campaign.
Oh, well, of course it does.
Right. So this is going to be exciting.
Everything does.
So,
do tell. Wait, let me. Get in here and relax. Hear your story.
So there's a member at a club that I belong to who is also a member. This is a pretty quick one, actually. Who's also a member at a club in Fort Myers.
Okay, which isn't far away.
Right? Southwest Florida, right. Mm-hmm. So he had a house on the course on this club that he belongs to in Fort Myers.
So we're not using names of clubs, I take it.
I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
I mean, I guess.
So we have a club in. Well, no, we'll just keep it simple. We have a club in Naples and we have a club in Fort Myers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And he has a house on the club in Naples.
He has a house on the club in Fort Myers.
Okay. Got it.
Or he did.
Oh, no.
Because he got divorced.
Oh.
Okay. That's fine. And so he, part of the divorce settlement, the wife gets the house on this course in Fort Myers.
Are kids involved?
I don't know all those details. Okay. That's much less important than what I'm about to tell you next.
Okay.
So.
So they get divorced.
She had a restraining order against him.
Oh.
You know, these things happen in divorces.
No, I know. Divorces are so ugly and people allege things that aren't true sometimes just for spite.
Yeah.
And they're angry and they do things out of character because you've never been through a situation like that before.
Right, that's a voice of experience speaking.
You're damn right it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, darn right? Is that...
No, you can say damn. It's fine. We're talking about divorce.
I'm getting a potty mouth lately.
Yeah, we're talking about divorce. It gets a little chippy. I get it. So he gets divorced. There's a restraining order that's in force. And she has the house on the course in Fort Myers. So he can't play the ninth hole on the course that he belongs to.
Because the house is on the ninth hole.
Right. And it's within the radius of the order of protection.
Oh, no.
So.
Oh, my God. Well,
he belongs to a club. And by the way, this just in. Apparently it was not an amicable divorce. In case the order of protection didn't tip it off, the fact that she would actually seek to enforce it such that he couldn't play a full round of golf at the club that he play that he belongs to, where his former home is situated, you know, that you have to skip from 8 to 10. I mean,
can he play number
like
8
that.
Twice?
Well, yeah, but, you know, the guys you're playing with probably don't want to play number 8 twice.
Well, wait, then how does he, I mean, can he?
He has a 17-hole handicap, or at least he did for a time.
Wait. So then when he's done with the 8th, How did he
apparently
just
he has to go
over?
Apparently he has to go right to 10 or right to jail. One of the two.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line anytime with your bad divorce stories at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, that's just one of the great. I've never heard of something. I mean, it's not, you know, big financial this or whatever. I've just never heard of something so petty as that. And I don't know the backstory and the order of protection and who, what the allegations. And I mean,
well, did she purpose? Here's the thing. Do we know she purposely did this so that he couldn't play the ninth hole?
No. But I mean, I have no idea. But the fact that that was the effect, and the fact that she had to be serious enough about its enforcement to execute the order of protection if he was on the ninth fairway and was in the range, and she's on the phone to Fort Myers local. So, I mean, you know, I guess we're talking about this with somebody too. It's like, he'd probably want to, like, if you're playing a money game or you're in a match. I bet for the time, now this is no longer in force. I think he can play 9 again.
Okay.
So a full 18 at this club. But, I mean, if you're like in a match or you're playing for money, you want to start at 10 because you need to try to close out before you get around. Because otherwise you start out down 1,
oh
basically.
My gosh.
Yeah.
That is a good reason why Dan Proft is single.
It really is. I mean, that's just, you know, you pay for a house on the course, you pay for this club, you're still a member of the club, you give the house as part of the settlement, and then you can't even, I mean, and then it's not that the house isn't enough of a reminder of things going sideways, but now I can't even play. All right. Well, this gives me to RFK Jr., and what he said in a deposition during his divorce from his second wife.
Wait, so this one, Cheryl's his third wife?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
He said in a 2012 deposition that he has health issues caused by a worm that got into my brain and ate a portion of it and then died.
Yeah, why I saw Dr. Sanjay Gupta holding a brain and talking about worms that die in your brain.
Right. Yeah, it's
I was wondering, what is going on here? What is
it's a public health crisis. So why did he say that? Because it has negatively impacted his earning potential. So he was trying to get his payout down in the divorce from his second wife. Worm that got into my brain, ate a portion of it, and then died. RFK Jr.'s poisonous brain matter.
Are you buying that?
What's with the Kennedys and brain? Oh, no,
hey.
We won't even go there. He also said that he suffered from mercury poisoning.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, this guy's lucky to be alive.
But a dead parasite in your brain, I mean, how does one get it out? Do you use this just your new buddy?
I'll tell you.
Pet worm?
It just, I don't know. I mean, his PETA friends may file a wrongful death suit on behalf of the brain worm. But the...
he said, so the worm ate part of his brain, causing memory loss and mental fogginess.
Yeah.
And it then died. The end.
But he's fine now. The worm is not, the parasite in RFK Jr.'s brain does not negatively impact his ability to be president of the United States. He wants you to know.
Well, Dr. Gupta, he said he is, you know, he's an experienced neurosurgeon. He said that he has removed parasitic worms, from patients.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
He said it's very rare, but it does occur.
Yeah.
Among individuals who consume undercooked pork. Was I just trying to make a pig noise?
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
I just, could this presidential race get any more bizarre?
I know.
RFK. And also, I mean, the lengths you go to try to protect assets in these proceedings.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but his voice is...
That's a neurological condition. I don't think that's worm related. I think that precedes the worm. I don't think the worm eating part of his brain helped. But that's what
are we going to name the worm?
This is going to, by the way, this is going to be the new political excuse that's used, and you'll just dummy up MRIs. For anybody I offended, I want to apologize, but a worm has eaten part of my brain, and it's caused some cognitive impairment. But I'm fine to stay in whatever position I'm trying to keep. I just want you to know. The worm ate my brain excuse. Tony on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Tony. Good morning, Amy, Lam, and Dan. You know, in terms of marriage, you always hear about, well, not in terms of marriage, but, you know, everybody's saying three times the charm, right? In terms of marriage, I'm going to say four. Here's the reason why. I remember hearing an interview with Mickey Rooney when he spoke about his fifth wife, Barbara Ann Thompson, being murdered. Okay, so that's five. So three, four times is a charm. Five, no can do. That's why Dan's not married. Take care, guys.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Okay. Steve in Lake Geneva.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Love you guys. My morning intelligent humor. The guy in Naples, at least now he can break 80 a little easier. She did him a favor.
Well, yeah, you would think, but technically, you know, if he wants to keep a gin handicap, he's got to take an X on 8, and so he's got to take the max he can take, so double or triple, depending on how good he is. You know? So, but the, thanks for the call, Steve. But that's probably the good news because it inflates his handicap, because I'm sure he wouldn't get a double or triple on 8 every time he played. So, yeah.
I like how you're thinking that out. Hey, if you ever do get married, can I be your flower girl?
No.
And Justin and Quinn and I want to start a Congo line.
That'll be fun. I may get married just for that. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. This could be a divorce thing if you fed your wife raw pork. Because if you go on YouTube, you can look at, if you pour Pepsi or Coke on raw pork, you can see the parasites come out of the meat.
Oh, gross.
Well, check it out.
thanks for the call, Larry. Yeah, all right. I mean, I don't know if that's how RFK Jr. got his brain worm, raw pork. I mean,
Dr. Gupta said. Yeah. That's the times that he's a neurologist, and he has gotten dead worms out in all the cases. Yeah, but, it was a worm from undercooked pork.
Yeah, but that would be in your digestive system. How does the worm get in your brain?
You're asking me.
Yeah, well, you're the Dr. Gupta correspondent.
Well, he had this brain out that would look like a bowling, multicolor bowling ball brain, and he just talked about how we go into the brain to get the worm out. But I don't know how the worm gets up there, but it does. Maybe it's a safe, warm spot for the worm, Dan.
Yeah.
You know?
The worm ate my brain.
And I can't make
the RFK Jr. story.
Yeah.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And it's nice to see that we're getting some Biden shots in from stand-up comedians. It's nice to see that that's, within the field of play. It's because, you know, you've got all the late night talk show hosts, that the Kimmels and the Colberts, that are just awful. They're just flack for the state.
Did you see
particularly
Stephen
this
Colbert?
Administration?
Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting you. And when we were at the RNC, remember, in Cleveland, did you run into him? Did you see him?
No.
Oh, I did. And he is a weird dude. There's something missing. There's something wrong.
Typical Northwestern grad.
Ugh.
Watch
him do his thing. Yeah.
You know, it's good to see that that this is fair game, that he's become an appropriate object of ridicule. So this was some random stand-up dude at the Comedy Store doing a set, and he was doing some crowd work, and he happens upon somebody who works for the Biden administration. And it went like this.
Nick, what do you do for a living now? You work for the Biden administration. Uh-oh. Is your job to wake them up, or what's your job?
Hey!
There's a war!
Hey!
Okay, what do you do for the Biden administration? What a show of a job you have. I can't believe you admitted that in front of all these people. You have the freedom to lie. You could have said you were a hooker, and I would have been prouder of you. What do you do?
I travel to
you go to the South and try to sell him on Biden? Retarded. What the are you talking about? That's your job is to go, hey, listen, I know you guys like Trump, but Biden, I mean, wow. Are you ready to be unemployed or what's your vibe?
Travels to southern states doing something on behalf of the Biden administration. That was the exchange there. Not great crowd work, but like I said, I'm just happy to see that it's in play, that we're at least with stand-up comedians, you know, per what Seinfeld has been saying, not going to see it on sitcoms. You know, that's all politicized and groupthink, and it's, you know, comedy, situational comedy is dead. But the stand-ups, more of the maverick set, and they're bringing it back where those in power, regardless of their political stripes, get ridiculed as is appropriate. You try to find encouraging notes wherever you can. So, just saying.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've got a force multiplier occurring in Denver. You have a keffiyeh-clad pro-Hamas protester bringing the encampments together.
Oh.
Encampments from college for the basically mainly privileged honkies. And the migrant encampments. Migrants protesting, as there has been some complaints from migrants, people in this country illegally, about the quality of the goods and services that are being provided them.
Right. Like in Massachusetts, they didn't like the food, so they called the local eye team out there and said, this is what we're eating. But then they turned it into our tax dollars are paying $27 a day for meals that really, I think, a hot dog surrounded by rice.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not Chateaubriand. I get it. I mean, if you don't like the food, you know, feel free to take your business elsewhere.
Yeah,
I
suppose. You can always go back home.
But this coming together, this is a great example of what the left does: the solidarity and marginality. It's the same cast of characters that just move from one grievance to the next, and that's what you have happening there. They have some demands. As you might expect, a number of demands. Here's the press conference that
press
was held.
Conference.
Well, of course. Press conferences, just like these pro-Islamist terrorist protesters and college campuses do, negotiation teams and comms teams and press conferences and shouting demands through bullhorns and bitching about doctors not being on site and so forth.
I'm V Reeds with Hand, House Keys Action Network Denver. I use they, them pronouns.
Thank you.
My name is spelled V, just the letter V, last name R-E-E-V-E-S.
V Reeves. Got it. Thank you.
So we called for this emergency press conference because it became very clear from several meetings that we'd been having with the folks here at this encampment and also with other migrants that there needed to be clarification on the kinds of systemic conditions these folks are put under. There's a lot of dissidence and a huge amount of difference between what is coming out of the city and what the mayor is saying and what the reality of these people's lives are. There's also so many incredibly strong parallels that come between the cause for the unhoused migrants' rights here in Colorado and in the U.S., and then there are parallels with the fight for a free Palestine.
Of course there
now,
are.
Now, a lot of that comes from the fact that we're facing a common enemy. We're facing a colonial structure that decides that black and brown bodies are not of the same value as white European colonial settler bodies are.
She go away now.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't she white?
V. Reeves? I don't know if she identifies as white. She is
well,
a honky.
She is. She's
I don't know. Yeah.
Blonde hair.
Well, anyway, after she got done with, you know, her ideological diatribe, she made mention that they have 13 demands. And I'd like to go through them with you to make sure that we're all working off the same scorecard so that we can track how the negotiations between V. Reeves and the city of Denver go, since Denver is just one big college campus now as well, and make sure that people are in this country illegally have their demands met, just like we want to make sure that hunger strikers in Princeton, New Jersey have their demands met. That's what's important. I don't want to be perpetuating systemic conditions that are remnants of a colonial structure. Anyway, migrants will cook their own food with fresh, culturally appropriate ingredients provided by the city instead of pre-made meals, rice, chicken, flour, oil, butter, tomatoes, onions, etc. Also, people will not be punished for bringing in and eating outside food. Yeah, let's get back to farm to table for the migrants. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And V. Reeves will be monitoring, and her team.
Yeah, will be monitoring.
Will be monitoring that the city is compliant, and then also that the migrants don't eat any culturally inappropriate food.
This encampment is so gross. So they're protesting this city's shelter system, and it's underneath an overpass, you know, and
right.
it's trashed. Okay, there's
nothing
garbage
like,
everywhere, and there's Palestinian flags. I see two Palestinian
of course,
flags here.
Solidarity and marginality. So,
what the heck does that have to do with anything?
So, you're protesting the shelters by putting up a little tent encampment under an underpass. Okay, yeah,
and then release your demands, and then that encampment has Palestinian flags because you know that's the soup du jour. And you have demands that for taxpayers to provide better food.
All right. We've just gotten through the first demand. We want to make sure that everybody's on the same page here. Shower access will be available. By the way, note the language. They're not asking. They're telling. Shower access will be available without time limits. Because, I mean, they like to take a 20-minute hot shower just like I do. I mean, I get that. It will be available without time limits and can be accessed whenever. We are not in the military. We're civilians.
Oh, you're getting a little lippy there, huh?
20-minute
showers? I don't shower. I get in and out. I don't understand long showers.
I like long showers. It's a happy place to think, let your mind roam. So forth. Anyway, I digress. I'll let people think about me in my shower at their own leisure. Number three. Yeah, we only made it to three. They've learned something from the hunger strikers at Princeton. Medical professional visits will happen regularly, and referrals / connections for specialty care will be made as needed.
Somebody just texted, snowflake dinners matter.
Number four, will receive that same housing support that has been offered to others. They cannot kick people out in 30 days without something stable established. Okay. Number five. There needs to be a clear, just process before exiting someone for any reason, including verbal, written, and final warnings. Of course. Right. Basically, what they really need is sort of an HR department set up there for the migrants.
Yeah.
Number six, all shelter residents will receive connection to employment support, including work permit applications for those who qualify. Number seven, consultations for each person family with a free immigration lawyer must be arranged to discuss discuss and progress their cases. And the city will provide ongoing legal support in the form of immigration document clinics and including transportation to relevant court dates.
That's right.
Of course. The city will provide privacy for families and individuals within the shelter. No more verbal or mental abuse will be permitted from the staff, including no sheriff sleeping inside and monitoring 24/7. We are not criminals and won't be treated as such. That's number nine. Number 10, transportation for all children to and from schools will be provided until they finish in 3 weeks. That's number 10. Number 11, no separating families, regardless of if family members have children or not. The camp will stay together. What if the parents want to be separated from the kids? Number 12, the city must schedule a meeting with the mayor and those directly involved in running the newcomer program ASAP to discuss further improvements and ways to support migrants.
They're running out of space. They're running out of patience. They're running out of resources.
Not their problems. That's your problem. Figure it out. They're not asking. Number 13, the city must provide all residents with a document signed by a city official in English and Spanish with all of these demands that included a number to call to report mistreatment. Well, number 13, well, excuse me, Ms. V. Reeves, they, them, English and Spanish. How about native language? That's a little exclusive, don't you think? There are migrants from Asia, Chinese migrants, I'm sure, some in Denver, Africa. So it's not just English and Spanish, little lady, or
it's
little non-binary.
Yeah, 18 different languages.
Yeah. So, okay, all right. So now everybody's got it? We
Russian.
Clear? Mm-hmm. And that Johnston, that mayor of Denver, I mean, he's a honky, but he's on the same program as BLM Brandon. He's down with all the same struggles.
Oh, yeah.
And he's behaving like a university president, which is to say capitulating and deferring and enabling V. Reeves to shake down this little non-binary knucklehead to shake down the city of Denver's taxpayers.
Mm. She's wearing her Palestinian scarf. What do you call that thing again?
The kafeah.
The kafeah. She has it on.
Come on. Get with the nomenclature. The local Fox affiliate reported on this, too. I mean, it's wall-to-wall V. Reeves coverage on behalf of the migrants in Denver.
The camp, as a collective, came up with a list of demands.
That came after a petition by city officials for migrants to move from this encampment near train tracks, under a bridge, to indoor shelters funded by the city.
This morning, they sent buses to take people over without presenting that document. And without having any kind of signature for accountability.
That's what migrant advocate V. Reeves says the city responded with instead of meeting the migrants' demands.
We've been offering time and shelter, basically just trying to get families to leave that camp and come inside.
John Ewing with Denver Human Services says shelter comes with its perks, namely getting out of these conditions outdoors.
It comes with, you know, 3 square meals a day. You can cook your own if you'd like to.
That is one of the main demands by these migrants who have had their grievances in the past about the food provided by the city.
There have been so many complaints about the food being spoiled or not being enough and malnutrition amongst children.
Migrants who do stay in shelters are often put on a path toward a work permit. Reeves says these folks haven't received the same benefits.
They're not receiving any kind of official housing or immigration document support, which is incredibly necessary for them to be able to navigate the bureaucracy around these systems.
The city says its own offer comes with these benefits.
What do you qualify for? What do you not qualify for? What might be something that is a feasible path for you to success that is not staying on the streets of Denver? We try to compromise. We try to figure something out. You know, at the end of the day, what we do not want is families on the streets of Denver.
Yeah, so in all, the migrants sent a list of 13 demands to the city. The city, meanwhile, says it is continuing to send buses to this encampment for any migrants who change their mind and want to take that offer for city-funded shelter, whether it be congregate or in a hotel. We're live in Denver. Rahel Yamadis, Fox.
Yeah,
this is going great, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean...
Can I take the Palestinian flag with me, sir, if I go back to the shelter?
Well, the city is doing about... I'm always interested in the institutional response here, right? Uh-huh. So what the city's doing its best. You heard them. The city flack, you know, they can make their own food. Well, so that's great, son, but you need to provide culturally appropriate ingredients for the food that they want, may or may want not want to make. So what's the city's plan for that? Also, too, you know, I was just thinking about the showers, long as they want, you know, access whenever, 24/7, long as they want. I would make, if I could just offer a friendly amendment to that particular demand, I would make a water pressure demand, too. You know, I don't like, you know, like you get in a lot of hotels, like the dribble drabby shower. I want, like, you know, like fire hose water pressure so you can get, like, a little back massage kind of action going, you know, loosen up a little bit in the morning
with the
hot water. But you need the good water pressure. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they've thought about that. Maybe I'll conference with either V. Reeves or her designee in Chicago to make sure that that's included. Yeah, because there's always room to make more demands as things move along. You learn. As you go. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the story in Denver, and that will be the story in Chicago and every other major city in the next 5 minutes. So get ready. Harry in Holly, Michigan.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I think that a lot of these, whatever, government bodies, et cetera, they need to establish an Adopt-a-Migrant program and push it back on a V. Reeves and say, you know, if you want to support these people that through charity, tired of government building up our credit debt to do all these illegal things, so how about you and your parents go ahead and adopt a migrant or two, and you can take care of them just the way that you'd like to.
Yeah, thanks for the call here. These are not private action folk. These are collective action folk. These are not volunteers.
Right.
These are point of gun types. So I just don't think that's going to fly. Not to mention, most of them are dependents of the state or their parents to begin with, or some some combination of the two. So you know, they're dependents pushing dependency. So I just don't think you're going to get that sort of can-do spirit from V. Reeves and company. Ray and Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, these people are illegal immigrants, and they're gathering with a piece of paper with a list of demands.
Yeah,
doesn't the demands usually are accompanied with the or what? What's the or what? Are we talking bad Yelp reviews? What's the or what that they're going to do if they're not met with their demands?
Great question.
Thanks for what you guys do. Bye-bye.
Great question, Ray. What's the all right? It's an ultimatum, so what's the implicit threat? Let me tell you what the implicit threat is, especially now that they've been joined by the pro-Hamas protesters. Here's the implicit threat.
The people find you
guillotine. Off with their heads, Ray. Off with your heads. That's the R what. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Just in terms of what's going on college campuses, very interesting. Sometimes some of the useful idiots that have been trained at places like the Teamster Hall in Chicago and what to say and how to say it,
right,
sometimes they slip up.
Oh, they do? Like death to America, death to Israel? What is
no, that's not slipping up. That's what they're supposed to say.
Right.
But let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. This student at Florida International University, mm-hmm, not perhaps as prepared to be a good little propagandist as the Ivy League kids. They've had, you know, more training. Maybe they have more bandwidth when it comes to this sort of subversion. But this FIU student, she kind of messed up.
All right, I want to hear it.
She let it slip.
Uh-oh.
In every single protest that we have, our actions have had counter protesters, and there is never any backlash and never police protecting us. In fact, police are directly protecting counter protesters, even at our events. So I want to ask you all, is Palestinian life not worth mourning? And we as Arabs, Palestinian, Muslim, and anti-Jewish students, are we not worth protecting?
Did you say anti-Jewish students?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, please?
Did you say anti-Jewish students? Oh, so this isn't about the state of Israel. This is not about Bibi Netanyahu's policies. This isn't. I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm anti-Zionist. You know, these distinctions without much difference that these flacks try to offer, like Ilhan Omar, for example, or Rashida Tlaib, anti-Jewish students. Not non-Jewish students, anti-Jewish students is the phrase that she used. See, she let it slip.
Yeah, she's not ready for prime time. She's a try-hard. Yeah. But I'm glad she is, because it's good to expose them for who they are.
Yeah, it should be obvious, but it's always more helpful when they just say it explicitly, isn't it? For more on what's going on college campuses, and as we were talking about with respect to Denver, in Big Blue City America, because basically those are just big college campuses these days, pleased to be joined again by former Indiana governor and former Purdue University president, Mitch Daniels. Mitch, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
So, you know, you had to deal with perhaps not something on this order of magnitude during your time at Purdue, but maybe I'm misremembering. But certainly the people that wanted to protest and whatever the grievance of the day was. And, you know, how did you handle this as a university president, particularly maybe comparing and contrasting yourself from, say, the university presidents in the Ivy League or Northwestern, for example?
Our approach was, first of all, to establish early on, you know, clear protective policies around free speech. We routinely sought and got the best rating that the watchdog groups offer in terms of encouraging an atmosphere of free inquiry. But I think we were equally clear in telling people where the lines were. In other words, speech is different than conduct, and we protect the former and have rules about the latter. And then there are and speech that's addressed to a topic, no matter how asinine or insipid or offensive that speech is, we would protect, but not speech that was directed at a person, an ethnic group, or threatened anyone. And we enforced the rules as they needed to be. And I think that was the appropriate balance that people have been trying to strike. But also, there's a deterrent value to doing what you said you do. And I think that probably helped us have a calmer environment as these enthusiasms come and go.
Well, what if they try to set up an encampment in the main quad area? What would you do?
We would remind them that housing is the university's prerogative, and that's conduct of a kind that is outside our rules. There was, I'm happy to say, my successors done, I think, a very fine job in the current situation. They had a much milder version of what's gone on elsewhere, but there was a few tents or something of that kind. They told them they had to have them down by a certain hour. The students complied, had their say, but in this case, nobody had to go to jail.
And I mean, do you have so? I guess the question is, and maybe the answer is pretty straightforward. Outside of Ben Sasse, you know, in terms of the president of a significant university in terms of size and diversity, state university like the University of Florida, and then the quote-unquote prestige universities, and I really do put those in quotes these days, why isn't there more college presidents, administrations of universities that are following the Mitch Daniels example and your predecessor there at Purdue, it sounds like, or the example of, you know, like a Larry Arnn at Hillsdale College and some of the small liberal arts colleges where the culture is just so different that it's not going to go down like that. But at the big universities where you're going to have kids from a lot of different perspectives, including the pro-Palestinian, in some cases, pro-Hamas kids on campus, why just don't see the model that you said replicated? And go ahead, have your say, no matter how vile and asinine it is, as you said. But then there are lines, and then we enforce the lines. We got to, you know, referee this thing.
I'm going to take a half-full view, Dan, of what we've seen recently. First of all, you have to remember the dogs that didn't bark. There are an awful lot of places where we right. didn't have these problems, or they were handled in a very responsible way. Secondly, with obvious exceptions, I was a little bit cheered up that I think there's a little more boldness now. I think the worm has turned a little bit. We did see places call in law enforcement where necessary. We did see lots of arrests. We've seen here and there some suspensions. Now, my own view is some direct and prompt expulsions would be a very good idea. First of all, to emphasize the importance we place on having boundaries of civil behavior on campus. And secondly, as a deterrent to the future, the schools that do that are less likely to have this problem again and again. But I do think that there have been some signs of greater backbone this time than maybe we saw in 2020. Follow through is really important. You know, I keep emphasizing prosecutors. We've got a lot of them, and I'm afraid in your city, maybe this is an example, that won't prosecute even worse offenses. And if they don't prosecute these, that will send a very bad signal.
Well, but I mean, it's even worse than that. And this is at some smaller universities, too, like Emerson, where you had this was a week or 10 days ago. You had kids basically assault, not basically, they were assaulting police officers. One kid's got one of those empty Hinckley water bottles, and he's hitting a cop like over the head as the cops are pushing them, trying to get them out of this takeover of some building on campus that they did. And then ultimately the police relented. So there were some arrests made. Emerson College paid to bond the kids out that were arrested.
Well, you know, here we'll go back one level further. So many of the problems that we've seen on campuses, whether it's what we're discussing now or the excessive cost of college, can be traced to boards of trustees who didn't do their job, haven't over time.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this case, whoever's president there probably ought to be replaced by someone who will set a higher standard and represent the school better.
Thinking about this from a policy perspective, which you always do, you know, from federal level, obviously there are federal purse strings here. There is not just the student aid that the federal government provides, but also the research funding and other funding that flows from the federal government into colleges and universities. Trump has weighed in on this. So has Biden, in the sense of, I guess, unilaterally forgive and unconstitutionally forgiving student loans. But Trump is talking about looking at endowments, looking at funding of these universities, and using the power of the purse to try to institute some discipline from the federal level. What's your perspective about federal action as it pertains to everything under the umbrella of colleges and universities, starting with the violence on campus?
I would simply start by saying the federal government's broke. It needs to start reducing spending on all kinds of things, and this would be a fairly easy call. I might be more careful about research, because I do think that research into legitimate, at least scientific and technological advances, is a pretty important thing for us to do. But much of the rest the federal government does, whether or not colleges are using it well or misbehaving, is money we can't afford to borrow and print.
Yeah, I know. To take that indication and develop it a little bit more. I mean, but when you were contemplating a presidential run back a decade plus ago now, I guess, you wrote, gave a speech offered remarks about the so-called red menace, and you weren't talking about red China or the Soviet Union. We were talking about red ink. And, as a successful Republican governor and Republican leader, what's your perspective on debt and deficits? You know, we hear from the modern monetary theorists that deficits and debt doesn't matter. We have a chief economist or economic advisor for Biden who can't explain the difference between currency and purchasing power, doesn't really know why the government borrows money when it can't go bankrupt and so forth. I mean, really troubling ignorance on display. But the Republican Party doesn't really seem to have much of an appetite to take up this issue of debt and deficits. I mean, there's some jawboning about it, but you're not seeing substantial proposals in the direction of dealing with it.
Regrettably, that's accurate. You know, I probably couldn't write the same book or give the same speech today because there's been no evidence at all that that we could rally the country to address this as something we have in common. I mean, and we do have it in common. When, and I'm sorry to say it's when, not if, the crunch comes, it'll hurt virtually every American in one way, worse for the most vulnerable among us. So, no, you're right. Presidents and members of both parties have not only not addressed the problem, they have each in their own way made it worse. We have two candidates for president, each basically promising to make it worse. Modern monetary theory had a very short shelf life. It's on that shelf now with Lysenkoism and the Piltdown Man and other myths or frauds of the past. But you can pick up any at this point credible journal and find very mainstream people saying exactly what some of us have been saying for a long time, that you can't go on forever, that no endeavor of any kind can become as indebted as we are and not sacrifice its sovereignty and at some point. So I'm afraid it's going to take, as many have always said, a genuine crisis to bring about some necessary correction. But for the moment, it's obviously bad politics to tell people we can't go on as we have. And it's going to be a very, serious blot on the record of us as a self-governing people when we're forced to tell, for instance, Social Security recipients, sorry about your luck, money's gone, and we don't have a way to completely keep our promises to you.
Now, Indiana just recently had their primary on Tuesday, and I was wondering, I know you didn't endorse anybody for that, but now are you moving forward? Are you going to be endorsing the Republican nominee?
Well, Amy, I won't need to. You know, not to introduce a big topic you didn't call about, but we'll have a new governor. I'm hope he'll be a fine one. He's elected by 5% of the American public, the Indiana registered voters, because we are now a one-party state, as 40 of the 50 states are, and it's a new phenomenon. If you're in Illinois and you're a Democrat, I guess you're happy about it. If you're an Indiana Republican, you may be happy about it. But I'm not sure it's healthy long term. So we had a primary. 12% of the registered voters voted in the Republican primary, and the winner got less than 40% of that. So 5% of the registered voters have determined who our next governor will be. And I'm not sure that's a formula for, competition in business or any walk of life promotes innovation. It's always a good thing. Promotes improvement. And, when you get to a situation like ours, which is now typical, I'm not sure that you get the kind of progress that our free institutions have always produced.
I think that's a good point, and I think the contrast is well considered because, we've seen it, and there are examples in Indiana where, you get fat and happy and you start to atrophy a little bit. You start to stray away from the principles you said you were going to act in advance of when you ran and when you were elected. That can happen to conservatives too. In fact, or just even the rank and file Republicans. I mean, one of the reasons that Illinois is a one party state, as you properly described, is because the Republican Party, when it had its day back in the 80s and 90s, lost its way because it did exactly what I said. It became another spoils of war party, indistinguishable from the Democrats. And long term, the Democrats turned out to be better at it.
Yeah. And this is not a criticism of any of the, I guess, six candidates that competed this week. They did what made sense to win. They talked about things that really had nothing to do with being governor of Indiana. They were going to combat the Chinese and the hard left and the Mexican border and so forth. This state has problems and it has opportunities. They were not
incentivized to talk about those. We didn't hear a word about how we might improve our educational outcomes, about the fact that we're importing electricity where once we exported it and we're going to need more of it to be an economic power that we can be, all these sort of things. And so I do think that the lopsided politics, which are which various trends, social and otherwise, have brought us into, is not conducive necessarily to the kind of good give and take that our politics is capable of and in its best days produces.
Well, you're always a source of hope for Illinois because prior to your election, correct me if I'm wrong, and people forget this now because of the last two decades, but for the two decades prior to your election to governor, it was Democrat governors of Indiana, right?
Yeah, that's right. It seems like only yesterday, but we had a very balanced system. Half the time I served in that job, we had a divided legislature, and, you had to find ways to work together. You had to identify issues that a broad majority of the public could be enthusiastic about, not just a sliver on one end or the other. But that was then. We'll have to find ways to move ahead. Indiana's still doing fine. We're still receiving lots of Illinois residents.
Oh, yeah. That won't stop. Yeah.
I give you my business every weekend.
I used to, we saw so many Illinois students on our campus, I would always tell them, we have a generous asylum policy here in Indiana. we welcome people fleeing political oppression.
That's right. You should get some of U of I's money because you're basically become a U of I extension campus in part in West Lafayette.
They're a fine school, but Purdue's always been blessed and never more than today with a very large number, over 1,000 each year now, of students coming from Illinois.
All right. Very good. Very good. Mitch Daniels, former Purdue University president, of course, former governor of the great state of Indiana. Mitch, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A spate of stories when it comes to the race hustle. Some pretty encouraging, actually. Two teens kicked out of St. Francis High School in Mountain View, California, were awarded $1 million by a jury because they were improperly kicked out. The school saying that they took a picture when they were 14 years old of themselves in blackface when, in point of fact, it was just a green acne face mask that they were wearing.
Yeah, we've used those at home.
Uh-huh. They took a photo of themselves at the sleepover, 14-year-old boys during a sleepover in 2017, and 7 years later, they get a little bit of justice, $1 million. Catholic school, elite Catholic school. Right. Good. I'm glad the Catholic school there is going to take it in the pants.
Yep.
These elite schools, not much different than the government schools, as we've well documented. Just, go up the road to Wilmette and take a perusal of what's happening at Loyola Academy. Then there's this, like we have in Evanston, seeing more and more of this. Vermont housing program, $25,000 for forgivable loans for home buyers who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. Mm-hmm. Harvard Business Review. U.S. firefighters are overwhelmingly white and male. Here's why that needs to change. The Firefighters Union, which mainly serves as an appendage of the Democrat Party. Certainly that's the case in Chicago and Illinois. Heads up, gentlemen. Careful who you're in bed with. Don't come crying.
Might come back to bite you.
And, of course, college campuses. SIU had five separate segregated graduation ceremonies: Black, what? Hispanic, Asian, LGBTQ, and non-traditional. Yeah, segregation is the resegregation. It's the new fad, as we've, again, been documenting for years now. And it just keeps going. It just keeps going. This is an announcement by Flack for Governor Hochul of New York about this renovation of JFK that they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, big public works project. $2.3 billion in state funds to renovate JFK Airport. But, you know, it's not for the honkies.
What we didn't want to happen is to go back to the community. And, Jim, you know this. And people look at us and say, well, what did you do? No one on that project looks like us. No one in that project represents us. We did not want to have those conversations. And that's why those tireless meetings that took place on Zoom, it was Microsoft, WebEx or whatever it was, and it wasn't working, and your bandwidth, and you had to turn off the camera or turn off the mic. As annoying as it was, we knew it was for us. For us, by us, to make sure that this community that we represent looks like us. So I just want to say...
So it's, I mean, it's like the foundational document of the Brandon Johnson administration in Chicago. First you get the money. And again, as I'm always quick to say, the Irish did it. Italians did it in big cities. And so now, as more minority groups are ascendant and minority politicians are, Black politicians are doing it. Latino politicians are doing it. Asian politicians are doing it. Michelle Wu in Boston.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not race-based. It's between your ears-based. Identitarianism. And that eats more of your brain than that worm that was roaming around in RFK Jr.'s head. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Bob Woodson. Of course, he is the president, founder of the Woodson Center, and also 1776 Unites. And he is also the author of the bestseller, Red, White, and Black, Rescuing American History from Revisionists and Race Hustlers. Red, White, and Black. Bob Woodson, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure, Dan and Amy.
So help us take stock, because you're in this fight every day, and you have been for 60 years. So help us take stock of where we're at. We've seen some clawing back of DEI bureaucracies. But at this and some court cases that enforce anti-discrimination laws in every which direction, which are somewhat encouraging. But then you have still a lot of money sloshing around in the direction of identity-based politics.
Yeah, I think I have to give credit to my young colleague Delano Squires, and I just keep quoting him because he framed it beautifully. He said, really, this is a struggle among elites. This is guilty whites who are seeking absolutions from crimes they never committed, and guilty entitled blacks who are seeking absolution from injustice they never suffered.
Right, right.
It really is a battle of elites. And this is where you get into identity politics, and one is just one iteration of that. DEI is another iteration of it. But the reality is the people who are suffering as a consequence of this are not the ones that have a voice in framing these issues. This DEI and others has produced, as a friend said, a deliberate inversion of moral values, a degradation of competence, and an implosion of social trust. And this takes expression in high crime in these areas as the police and lawful authority is diminished and degraded. But the real people who are suffering the consequences of these battles, at least, are the people who are most vulnerable in these communities. And that's why it is important to go directly into these communities and listen to what these voices are saying. The Woodson Center is in about 39 communities representing about 3,000 low-income grassroots leaders of all racial groups. And I spent a lot of time in these communities. And if you look at survey data, 80% of blacks do not support defund the police. They don't support these race grievance issues. They are unalterably opposed to it. But the qualities that make them effective make them invisible. And that's why it's important for us to, in terms of pushing back against it, to go to the people in the community in whose name the left say they are representing them and give them a voice in speaking out against these. And that undermines the moral authority of the left. We did this in Utah. I met with the governor. I met with the leader of the House, the Senate, also 35 grassroots leaders in Salt Lake City. And we had public forums and discussed this. And so when the legislature offered this legislation to take down and remove DEI, it was supported by people in the community, low-income, black, brown, and white groups. And as a consequence, it was dismantled. And that's where we've got to fight this. It cannot just be conservatives whining about what the left does on television and writing white papers about it.
Mm-hmm.
We must invest in those groups in these communities who understand that the continued erosion of moral values, attacks on the fundamental values of this nation, have a consequence of degrading the quality of their life. This isn't some intellectual exercise where people's feelings are hurt.
Well, did they ever
understand
ask?
Understand that their children are being lost. And so it is important for us to join in partnership with these and invest in these grassroots leaders. And that's how we can push back against DEI, where we did it in Utah.
So that's why hundreds of DEI programs are now failing, you know, or sorry, falling out of favor across America?
Absolutely. Corporations are spending $8.6 billion on DEI programs where law firms have to meet DEI requirements. It's almost like a communist checklist. But it's falling out of favor, and that's why it's being dismantled. In Virginia, University of Virginia spent $20 billion on DEI program. One black staffer makes a $500,000 salary training white people to be less racist. Making white people less racist doesn't make black people safer. And low-income people understand that that's a waste of resources that should have been spent on helping to heal those communities from within. And so you're seeing what they're doing in Utah is shifting it away from race-based needs to students who are struggling more of a class-based emphasis, and that's where we ought to be placing it.
I mentioned this the other day. I want to get your take. It seems to me there's a moment coming, and I don't know exactly when and exactly where, but the situation with Eric Adams and Brandon Johnson and Karen Bass and that Bill Johnston, the mayor of Denver, and Brandon Scott in Baltimore. I mean, these are all interchangeable people. It's different people, different names in different big cities all doing the same thing. And it's producing the same results, expectedly, which are bad. And it seems to me there is a vacuum in terms of opposition because these are all one-party cities. But there's a moment coming because of the sort of layering of social pathologies and importing them with respect to the lawlessness at the border and how that's manifesting itself in big cities, the big blue cities. Where there's going to be a new cadre of leadership that's incubated in these cities that has a different approach. And, you know, they may not call themselves a Republican, but they're going to be more commonsensical or a solutionist like you, Bob. Probably it will have to be young and black, just the nature of it, or younger, you know, under 60. But do you see, and I'm not sure I can point to an example of somebody that I think is, you know, just off stage and ready to come on stage in one of these places. But you're much more on the ground than I am, and I just wonder if you see that moment coming too.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's already a rebellion in place. You see where if you look at even the television that can't to the extent you got grassroots people like in Boston, in Roxbury, for instance, where the mayor is entertaining some exclusive black legislators, and then the next week she goes to a recreation center in the middle of low-income black Roxbury and takes a gymnasium that the community has been trying to get the city to renovate for 10 years, and instead they have now 120 beds for migrants in there, in that black community. They're not putting migrant centers out where the sons, where the Harvard professors live. It's in the low-income black community. And those low-income groups, leadership is in outrage, and they're speaking up. The same that is happening in Chicago. Grassroots leaders are saying to the mayor, you can't put any more shelters here, or why are you spending the teachers' unions demanding $50 billion in new, when in fact the kids are failing in those systems. No, there is a quiet rebellion going on. Leadership is emerging from those communities whose neighborhoods are being overrun. I really believe that low-income black people are black patriots. As I travel around these communities, they are not confused about their pronouns. You don't hear the discussion about pronouns and gender identity in these communities. In fact, you'd be laughed off the scene if you ever came in with that foolishness. But again, we must do more to shine a light and provide the means for these low-income indigenous leaders to rise up. You see it in Denver, where even the liberal mayors are now saying that homeless people should go to New York and Chicago.
Right.
And I think that the very stress that is produced and the hypocrisy is evident, is self-evident. Here's Maxine Waters talking about some mythical white waiting in the wings for to invade, when in fact her city, the campuses are inflamed in UCLA. In Portland, Oregon, 14 police cars were burned by left-wing radicals. But you don't hear anyone on the other side, progressive side, talk about what are we going to do about left-wing violence. More people have been arrested on these campuses, then we'll rest of this January 6th.
Right, but a lot of them aren't being charged. I mean, they're being arrested, but they let them go. And what message does that send?
Right, but the point is, I think the hypocrisy of it all is becoming self-evident, and that's what's going to compel change in these cities when some of these liberal mayors are confronted with the hypocrisy of their sanctuary city proclamations. When they're confronted with the reality of what that means, when people have to take resources that could go to help solve the problems of poverty among the people who have been paying taxes, it's going to be imploding. That's why we've seen an explosion of interest in our curriculum. For instance, we have 160,000 downloads of our red, white, and black curriculum in all 50 states, even states like New Hampshire and Oregon are looking at it. So I think there's a quiet rebellion going on, but we're trying to do at the Woodson Center is to try to get some high net worth individuals to make more deliberate investments in these communities so that these patriots can really stand up and defend this nation, its values. Because again, the people in these communities that are suffering with high crime and drug addiction, they are the ones who have the greatest stake in supporting the values of this nation, of family, of faith, and country. they are the real patriots that we need to be paying attention to.
He is Bob Woodson, the founder and president of the Woodson Center, author of Red, White, and Black, Rescuing American History from Revisionists and Race Hustlers, and also Volume 2 is out, A Pathway to American Renewal, Red, White, and Black, Volume 2, Pathway to American Renewal. It's available for pre-order on Amazon, so do that. Red, White, and Black, Volumes 1 and Volumes 2. Woodson Center is the organization to support, along with 1776 Unites, but it's all a collective there in furtherance of those principles that Bob laid out. Bob, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a blessed day. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Lights and sirens will fill the emptiness, my dark night. But who'll be there to wrap me in their arms and keep me safe from harm forevermore? Who else will be?
Well, that is the work product of Effingham native Austin Edwards. It's called Final Call. It actually was a song that got him and his brother inducted into the National Law Enforcement, or the American Police Hall of Fame.
Oh, good.
Yeah. He is he's one of the artists performing at Patriots Fest May 18th in Aurora at the Piazza, patriotsfest.com for tickets. And speaking of tickets, we've done two ticket giveaways this morning. Russell and Jefferson Park got the first two, and Rolf and Desplaines got the next two. Here's the last pair that we're giving away today. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line for two tickets, complimentary, of course, to Patriots Fest, May 18th in Aurora at the Piazza venue. To what caller? What number caller?
I'd like caller number 12 in honor of Mother's Day, which is May 12th.
Oh, very good. Okay. Yeah, caller number 12 gets those two tickets to Patriots Fest May 18th. By the way, I'm still just chuckling about our interview with the Motor City Madman, the Nuge, yesterday.
Oh, he's great.
I mean, he is just a force of nature. The anybody who wants to debate me about Biden can call 1-800-NUMBNUT. Ted Nugent is standing by at 1-800-NUMBNUT if you want to have that discussion. Austin Edwards, Effingham native, and Amy, of course, you think Effingham, and you think?
I think of family. We have family in Alton and Effingham.
There's a bit of a landmark in Effingham.
Is it the Lincoln statue? No.
It's the 200-foot cross that you can't miss when you're driving by.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But not off of I-55, off of I-50.
I didn't say I-55. Okay. But it'd be 57.
57, yeah.
Anyway, that is from where Austin Edwards hails. By the way, he's a veteran.
Good.
Also a law enforcement. Want to hear about that. Third-generation law enforcement. Because, a reminder, that Patriots Fest, 100% of the proceeds going to support veterans organizations serve our underserved veterans. Austin Edwards, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you this morning?
Great. Tell us about your upbringing in God's country. We used to call all of Illinois God's country. Now it's really limited to very few locales like Effingham.
Sure. I tell you what, growing up in Effingham, it was called the Crossroads of America.
Right.
And it's where all the major interstates went through in the Midwest, and the railroad lines as well. But growing up there was amazing. It was definitely small town atmosphere. It was very family oriented, and the cross was never there when I was younger. So as they built that cross, a lot of people drove through Effingham and they're like, "Wow, this must be like a really, you know, Bible thumping community, you know, because of this huge cross." And it was kind of, you know, ironic in a way that long before that cross was ever there, it wasn't that it was a Bible thumping community, but it was that it was very family oriented, and it was a community that people stood beside each other, behind each other, and they lifted each other up, a lot like the way this country used to be. And I certainly miss the days of Effingham. That's no joke there.
And what your dad was a skilled 12-string guitarist, your mom a pianist, and you said that your fondest memories were growing up when people would come over and play and sing at your house.
Absolutely. So my father was he was a Vietnam veteran, and he was also a policeman. And my grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather were all military as well. And so we had a very, very interesting dynamic in the family. But my father's partners on the police department, a lot of them played music, and they found music to be a release from what they do in their day-to-day job. And yes, my mom played piano, and my dad played 12-string guitar. I grew up in that environment. It was absolutely normal to have music, live music, playing in the house every weekend. You know, so.
And you were law enforcement too.
I am. Yes, I currently am. Yeah.
Oh, you are. What do you do? Are you a police officer?
I am. Yes, I work. I work a homicide division on the West Suburban Major Crimes Task Force on the west side of Chicago.
Oh wow! Oh. I didn't. Oh, okay. That's sort of burying the lead. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Come on in.
And so
we're not busy at all. If you've seen.
Yeah. Oh, no. Right. You know. I don't know what kind of. Well, I guess it was probably country oriented, but sort of like your family, sort of like cop rock. You're police officers, but then you sing and dance at the. I don't know if you do it at the station, but you do it at least on the side.
You never know what happens. So. There's room for anything, I guess, nowadays.
Yeah, right. So, okay, so how have you, how do you balance a career in music? I know you were on America's Got Talent, and you've got, an album coming out, right? I mean, do they still call it an album? I don't know.
They call it a lot of things, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But so how tell us about that balance.
It's a difficult balance. I'm a full time policeman. I do music as full time as I can, and I'm the most important job that I have is the job that I love the most, and that's I'm a full time daddy. In fact, we're being joined right now by a very special guest, my just turned 12-year-old son Colton, who is a drummer, and he's experiencing that today with us right now. So. He's a large part of that, and my daughter, and in learning how to balance that family and music and work, that's the goal of everyone's life, and it's very difficult. But you find time to do the things that you love, you just make it happen.
How long have you been with the homicide division?
This will mark my 18th year.
Oh my! And I just talked. I mean, do you feel fear for your safety when you go to work every day? Or
yes, there are definitely times that that you go through those. But as I tell my son, what do I tell you, son? You can't be courageous unless you have fear, right? Yeah. So that's when your bravery sets in. So you got to push through your days, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, not that it isn't obvious, but the Patriots Fest. I mean. You're like the poster guy for Patriots Fest, the whole point, a veteran law enforcement officer, in a tough beat too. So, how did you get involved with Patriots Fest? I know you've played with, some top country artists in particular, but, your involvement in Patriots Fest, and the organizations it's supporting and, you know, your sort of call to action for it.
So, we had written a song called Miss America, and we had written a song called American Song. And those songs kind of got passed around through some of the people down in Nashville. And lo and behold, somehow it ended up in the hands of the decision makers for the Patriots Fest. And they reached out and asked me if I would be interested to do that. And I was like, absolutely. Absolutely would.
And so, again, Patriots Fest is May 18th. It's at the Piazza in Aurora. PatriotsFest.com is the website where you get tickets. And Austin Edwards, where do they find out? I mean, in addition to you performing, obviously, but where do they find more of your music and follow your career?
Austin Edwards music across the board, on all the social media, Spotify, stuff like that. And that's amazing that you actually, you know, nobody ever plugs the artist anymore. So thank you for plugging. It's always shameful when we plug ourselves. So thank you for doing that.
I'm used to, yeah, because I'm always plugging myself. So I'm used to, you know, right, being shameless. You know, yes.
You know the feeling then, right?
Exactly.
But Patriots Fest is an amazing thing. I'm really honored to be a part of it. Fulton, what's your favorite part about Patriots Fest, buddy?
I would say the fact that you're helping veterans.
See, that I love that.
There you go.
So,
hi, Colton.
So my son agrees.
Is he gonna sit in for a set? Maybe?
I don't know. He's a heck of a drummer, though. So maybe I might bring him up there for a set. We'll see.
You should.
I love it. Austin and Colton Edwards. There's another duo has formed.
Yep.
All right, Austin Edwards. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I said there you go.
Oh, okay. Patriots Fest. PatriotsFest.com is where you get tickets. May 18th. The Piazza in Aurora. Austin Edwards. Three Doors Down. Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman, and a great collection of other artists. Austin Edwards, thanks so much for joining us, and have fun at Patriots Fest.
God bless you guys, and thank you for having me on, and hope to talk to you guys soon one day.
Oh, yes. God bless you, too. Stay safe out there, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
All right, just out from the Babylon Bee. This is good.
All right, I'm ready.
Donald
involved Stormy Daniels.
No, Donald Trump Bible readings.
Okay.
So, for example, I selected some of my favorites.
Yes, do tell.
John 11:35. Mm-hmm. Jesus wept, that verse.
Jesus wept, which I have never done, by the way. Never wept, not a weeper. Not a crybaby.
Nehemiah 6:15, building the wall around Jerusalem.
So the wall, the big, beautiful wall, was finished on the 25th day of the month. Finished in just 52 days. Everybody said I couldn't do it, but I did. And our enemies were shocked, believe me. And the Babylonians paid for it.
Leviticus 19:27, to not, you know, the admonition to not practice pagan,
right,
paganism.
Do not cut the hair at the sides of your head, but rather let it grow long and golden and swirl it across the top.
John 14.
I could do this all day.
14:6. My father's house has many homes.
In my father's house are many rooms, just like Mar-a-Lago. Rooms worth a lot more than $18 million, let me tell you that.
Many rooms, yeah, not many homes. Last one, Mark 1:15. You know, the time is at hand for the kingdom of God, which is perfect timing, because that's what we're going to talk about with Victor Davis Hanson, too.
The kingdom of God has come near. Repent and believe the good news, not the fake news like CNN. They're terrible, folks. They're terrible.
It's so good. It's so good. There's a lot more, too. Donald Trump Bible readings brought to you by the Babylon Bee. Well done over at the Bee.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Thomas Sowell interview by Peter Robinson from a couple months back on the occasion of his latest book, Thomas Sowell's. Asked if the, essentially Peter Robinson asked, if the identitarian left got everything they wanted, what would be happening in America right now? And Thomas Sowell said simply, we'd be killing each other.
Yep.
Certainly looks like Thomas Sowell was over the target, as he normally is, with just some of the manifestations of people. Boy, if they weren't restrained at least a little bit by law enforcement, what they would be doing on college campuses and in urban centers. Now add in the possibility of a real economic downturn. The sugar high that we've been on, thanks to a decade of quantitative easing, which is just loose monetary policy, which is printing money, and combined with the massive print and spend that occurred during COVID. Well, there's some people suggesting that a significant downturn and market correction are not that far in the offing, as we're in a stagflationary environment. So you already have three quarters of Americans basically saying things are not going well for me economically because my wages aren't keeping up with price increases. And now take a real hit to principal and go up the economic food chain a little bit too with that hit. There's some people that are worried, and even shocks to the system because of the monomaniacal focus on getting Trump and imprisoning him at all costs. Kevin Hassett, who was an econ advisor to Trump, he's a fund manager now, he had this to say about the circus in Manhattan and its potential economic impact, depending on what Judge Merchan wants to do. On with Maria Bartiromo yesterday.
But the big risk, the outlook for me is something I've never seen before. That I really think if you look at the case in New York, that the judge is being so, you know, undemocratic, unconstitutional in his rulings against President Trump. It really looks like there's a conspiracy to put him in jail, to put him behind bars. And if President Trump is in chains going to Rikers Island, then, like, would you want to buy a U.S. Treasury the next day? The thing that I'm really worried about short-term risks for the economy, is that the Democrats are serious in this lawfare, and if they actually succeed, then imagine, it's like we become a banana republic the moment they take them to Rikers, and I just can't imagine what happens to Treasury markets that day.
Wow, so you think if that actually materializes, markets will take note?
Markets will take note, and it'll be one of the bigger market effects that we've ever seen.
We are on the razor's edge. That's what VDH is saying. Victor Davis Hanson, longtime classicist, California State University of Fresno, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's got a new book that is out. Pick it up, of course. Pick up everything VDH has written. The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. The End of Everything is VDH's new book. VDH, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You know, what do you think about what Kevin Hassett had to say? And I, not even just on the narrow issue of Trump being imprisoned on some contempt charge by the judge in that Manhattan case, but you know, in the context of everything that's going on around us.
Well, I know Kevin well. He's a colleague of mine at the Hoover Institution. He doesn't make wild accusations, and I think he's just formulating what all of us had already concluded, that the more this lawfare goes on, and I call it lawfare because these crimes have never been articulated or even charged against anybody else. They're all unique in their own way. And the longer it goes on, the longer people, both our enemies who say the Chinese or the Russians say, well, they're just like us, and more our allies get worried that we're tearing ourselves apart. And in the terms of the economic realm, I think what he's saying is if the economy was booming, as Biden says, it wouldn't matter as much. They would just write it off the politics. But we're borrowing $1 trillion every 100 days. And the Build Back Better and the Inflation Reduction Acts were the biggest inflationary government boondoggles in history. So I think what Kevin's saying is that at this critical juncture, we need to be very sober and judicious. And what's happening, we're turning into a third world Latin American dictatorship type of law. Jurisprudence, and that, and we don't have any margin of error. I think he's right about that.
We talked to former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels a little bit earlier on the show. We're talking about the campus chaos and you know, vileness that's occurring on college campuses and in the streets, spilling over. Of course, we're all in one big college campus now. But a point he made, trying to look at the glass as half full, is don't forget about the dogs that don't bark. Don't forget about all the people on the college campus that are going about their business, that are serious students. Don't forget about the people that are being productive in the larger economy and so on and so forth. So how do you net that out when you consider that, of course, the people that make spectacles of themselves are going to get disproportionate attention, but it's not necessarily representative? And, you know, it's sort of a 2024 version of the silent majority. Is that going to be enough to stave off some of this banana republicanism you're speaking of?
I hope so. But the problem in particular on these campuses are that the administrations and the faculty and the minority, and a clear minority of students, are in control of the apparatus. And they can cancel the graduation. They give 80% of all grades A's at Yale. They are in tune with blue state mayors and governors, because these are all in mostly blue states, these bubbles and campuses. It's kind of analogous to the larger picture that all of Biden's issues on the border, the economy, foreign policy, crime, they don't even poll 40%. But he's running neck and neck, supposedly, because this small minority controls the media, the foundations, K-12, academia, many of the corporate boardrooms, entertainment, popular culture. So when you look back in history and you say, well, how in the world did the Bolsheviks ever take control? Nobody wanted them. The Mensheviks were much more popular. Or how come there was a reign of terror in 1793 that the Jacobins were a bunch of crazy, wealthy, spoiled brats that started guillotining people? Or how did the National Socialists take control?
Did we lose VDH?
They only won 33% of the vote.
VDH, we lost you there for a second when you cut out when you were talking about the spoiled brats of the
Jacobin
phrase.
What I was saying is that in history, these spoiled brats, they don't have a majority, is what I'm saying. And yet they exercise power, whether it's the Bolsheviks in Russia, where they were a minority, or the Jacobins during the French Revolution, or the National Socialists that had a minority of the vote in 1933. So they control the universities, they control the faculty, they control the administration, they control the blue state mayors and governors, and they have the ability to cancel graduation for everybody, or they result in 80% of the people getting A's at Yale. So I'm happy that none of the issues that Biden is promoting on the border crime, as I said, deterrence, have majority support, but he's still in power. And he's pretty close in the polls, because when you control the media and the entertainment and the popular culture, you have power that's not commensurate with your small percentage of popular support. And that's what I think the Republicans and concurrents have neglected. They have neglected the universities. They've neglected the power of the media. They've neglected the foundations. And I think they've sort of retreated into, I can't deal with these crazy people. I'm going to go to Tennessee, or I'm not going to watch the Oscars anymore, or I'm not going to send my kid to Stanford. But they need to get re-energized and say, you know what, these are not their institutions. These are our institutions, and we're not just going to give them up to these people in the 21st century. These institutions, the Rockefeller Foundation, was not intended to be as it is, and the Constitution didn't allow to get rid of the Electoral College, say, from this National Voting Compact they're trying to push. But I think everybody's got to get engaged, because yes, they're a minority, and most students are wonderful students, speaking to someone who's on the Stanford campus, but I watch the people who are the radicals and the Middle Eastern students, and I know the faculty, and I know the administration, and they have the ability to, I guess the word is, wreck it for the majority, and they will if they're allowed to do that. And so far, I mean, if you look at Rutgers and Brown and Northwestern just recently, they negotiated. I mean, they gave these radical, violent protesters everything they wanted. They said there'll be Palestinian fellowships from Gaza. We'll have more Middle Eastern professors. We will use the word genocide and colonial and settler in our official communiques. So I guess what I'm saying is that absolutely right that the majority of students are wonderful, just like the majority of Americans. But we're dealing with something that we've never really dealt with in years. This isn't the Democratic Party. It's something different. It's a revolutionary, progressive, strident, intolerant, and they're willing to do any means necessary, whether it's lawfare or storm Hamilton Hall at Columbia or do anything. And they don't have popular support. So if just one college president said, you know what, if you break the rules, you're going to be suspended. If you're here on a student visa and you're suspended, you're going to go back to the Middle East. That would stop it.
Your book, The End of Everything, your new book, How Wars Descend into Annihilation, it provides, you know, some historical examples, as you're wont to do, of where war broke out and the one side wasn't just defeated, they were annihilated, they were made extinct. And so, I mean, and I know there's a lot of parallels, and you've made some of them that are popular among conservatives, like to the French Revolution. But the historical examples that are cited in your book, are there parallels, maybe not perfect, but some parallels in terms of where we're at and what we should try to avoid doing?
Yeah, I think there are. It's very rare. Most wars, if you know, end in surrender. Even World War II, we didn't annihilate the Japanese and Germans. We recalibrated or rebooted them. But every once in a while it happens. And I pick, you know, ancient Thebes, Carthage, Constantinople, and the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan to show that sometimes it does happen. And is there a pattern? And there is a pattern. And there's other examples I alluded to as well, where these majestic civilizations feel that they're running on fumes and they don't reinvest in themselves. So they're financially strapped, or their militaries are weakened, or their wall, and they look at their walls and they say, nobody has ever breached the walls of Constantinople or Carthage. We're indomitable. And they underestimate their enemies. They have no idea who Scipio or Alexander the Great is. So when I look at the present time, and in the epilogue, I look at, you know, Iran threatening Israel, Ukraine being threatened with nuclear weapons. The Armenian, Erdogan said he had a solution for the Armenians that his grandfather's used. He said he would send missiles into Athens if he had to. We all discount that, just as these ancient examples. People said it can't happen here. Nobody would ever destroy the ancient city of Thebes, Oedipus, Antigone. Nobody would do that. But so when I look at America, I think, well, we're spending all of this money. We're short 45,000 recruits that we've alienated, mostly white males from the working class who die at twice their demographics in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have this lawfare going on. Crime is out of control, and yet we withdraw in humiliation from Afghanistan. We can't deter the Houthis or Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran. And yet there's a sense of denial. We're the United States. This is what Biden always says. We're the United States. We got the best economy in the world. We're the strongest nation. But it's sort of that, like that decline is sort of like that famous line that everybody's quoting in Hemingway's Sun Also Rises. Bankruptcy comes gradually, then suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at what's going on, if you and I had this conversation 10 years ago, when he said, I said to you, Biden is going to destroy the border and 10 million illegal aliens are going to come in and they're going to demand free housing and free shelter and food, or they're going to demonstrate. And we're going to have a resurgence of anti-Semitism that no one has seen in the West since the Nazis. You would have thought I was crazy. I would have thought I was crazy. Yet that's normal now. And so that's what happens with these societies. Very dangerous development started to happen in Carthage, naivete, and they just said they won't do this, they can't do this. You don't believe the Romans would ever level it. Constantinople, people on the wall said the Western Roman from Rome will come and help us. The Sultan doesn't really want to destroy us. People said he was tutored by Aristotle. He would never destroy a language, a civilization, a city. And it happens. And so I'm just thinking that what prevents it from happening in our time and space is a strong United States. We make sure that the Houthis can't destroy the Red Sea, the commerce. We destroy the Eastern. We ensure that nobody interferes in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Straits of Hormuz, or the Black Sea, and all of those. Just to take that example, including the South China Sea, no one controls those situations now except illiberal regimes that will You know, so you can't use the Red Sea, you can't use the South China Sea, you can't use the Black Sea, you can't use the Straits of Hormuz unless we let you. And that's pretty much what's happening. And so it's very insidious is what I'm trying to say, and denial and naivete and reliance on past and lost gender, all of those symptoms, and then a complete underestimation of enemies. And I don't think we take seriously the Chinese at all. I don't think we understand what their agenda is, what their students are doing here, what their trade is intended for, what fentanyl going to Mexico is, what the idea behind that is from China. So there are similarities.
He is Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution. His new book, The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. Pick it up now. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.